And now I'd like to introduce the moderator of our program. To my far right, we have Alaska World Affairs Council Board Chair as well as Professor of History at UAA, Dr. Paul Dunscombe. And I'll turn the microphone over to you to introduce our speakers.
Hi. Thank you very much, Lisa. And thanks to all of you for coming out. I would say on this snowy Friday, but it's not quite snowy, but it is at least enough to cover our shame finally. So I'm very pleased to see it. I realize sight lines in today's venue are not necessarily of the best, but I hope you can all see the front stage and our two guests today to talk about the subject of refugees. On my far left is Jessica Kovarik. She's State Refugee Coordinator and Program Director, Refugee Assistance and Immigration Services for Catholic Social Services, which basically handles refugees on behalf of the United States. And to my immediate, my immediate left, is Margaret Stock, attorney with Cascadia Cross-Border Law Group. They handle international immigration and citizenship law, among other things. Relevant to our discussion today, she's also a retired Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Army Reserve Military Police, and was attached during the first decade of the 21st century, which we still haven't quite figured out how to describe, to the Central Command, or Southern Command.
Special Operations Command.
Special Operations Command, has extensive experience dealing with the refugee issue. So, obviously, even before recent events, the issue of refugees and immigration has always been a problem on which it's been somewhat difficult to have reasoned public discourse. So I definitely hope that today we can help add to that sum total in a meaningful sense. This is obviously a very important issue. Recent events have only made it more topical in a sense. So my first question would go to Jessica, and just to discuss, what is the difference between refugees and immigrants? Is it more than just a bureaucratic legal distinction?
Yes. So Margaret might be able to explain this a little bit as well, but there's a major distinction between an immigrant and a refugee. And the main difference is that refugees have not chosen to leave their home. They have been forced to flee their home due to a well-founded fear of persecution. It's a fear that they have to prove in order to get that label as a refugee. So they need to go through a process and go to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which will register the applicant. They will interview the applicant. And then if it's determined that they meet the legal definition of a refugee, then they will be granted refugee status, which is a legal definition. So the main difference is that refugees have not chosen to leave their home. They've been forced to flee their home.
Margaret?
And just to add to that, there's only five grounds for somebody being declared a refugee. You have to show a well-founded fear of persecution on account of your race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. So although we hear a lot about economic migrants, a person does not qualify to be a refugee just because they're starving and might die of starvation in their home country. That's not a legal reason to be classified as a refugee.
And so you've alluded to the existence of a process whereby one officially gets designated as a refugee. Could you talk about that process a bit? Let's start with
Absolutely. First, one thing I think people don't realize is that our situation here in the United States is very different from Europe. There's been a lot of coverage in the news of hundreds of thousands of people trying to rush the European border and come into Europe because of the conflicts in the Middle East. In America, when we call somebody a refugee, it means the person has gone through an overseas vetting process before they come to the United States. We don't have refugees in the U.S. who have not gone through an extensive process somewhere typically between 18 months and 2 years, sometimes even 3 years, before coming over to the United States. And they typically come on an airplane with documents. So when they hit the borders of the United States, they're perfectly legal. They're being admitted as refugees by the United States government, by Customs and Border Protection. It's a very different situation from the one in Europe. What happens during that process overseas? Well, we have provided you with a handout. If you take a look at that red and white handout, It explains the whole process that refugees go through overseas before they get to the United States. And this includes not only interviews, but extensive security checks. These have been downplayed a little bit in the news, but many, many years ago, U.S. government officials became concerned that bad people might attempt to use the refugee system to come into the U.S. Now, I should make a note that bad people want to use any system they can to get into the U.S., and if they can't use a system to get somebody into the U.S., they'll radicalize people who are here already and try to get them to attack us. So our adversaries are very savvy people, and they had looked at the refugee system a long time ago and said, aha, let's try that. And the U.S. government, being savvy in response, said, let's stop them from doing that. So the government, over the years, and more than 20 years of experience with the refugee system, has put in place a multitude of security checks. Now, no system is perfect, but this system is about as extensive as you can get with any kind of checks of a foreigner coming into the United States. It subjects a refugee to more checks than any other person coming to the United States, and it's carried out over a period of years by a multitude of different agencies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just want to echo what Margaret said, that an asylum seeker in Europe who registers with UNHCR is very different than somebody who's actually gone through the interviewing process with UNHCR and actually been granted refugee status, which is a whole separate system that happens before the U.S. refugee admissions process then is triggered once somebody's referred to resettlement. So there's a very big distinction.
And I wonder, Jessica, if you could expand a bit on what Catholic Social Services does and as part of this process.
Right, and I'll have to probably step back a little bit even to explain a little bit about the U.S. refugee admissions process. So basically, when somebody registers with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, they're interviewed. Several interviews happen. A best interest determination, or a BID, takes place to determine what is the best interest for that refugee. And the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and sort of the international system sees three possible durable solutions for a refugee. The first one is repatriation. So that's returning back to their homeland, as long as it's deemed safe. In 2014, about 127,000 people were returned back to their home. That's the lowest amount of refugees that have been ever returned home in the last 31 years. So what's happening is that more and more of these conflicts are happening in situations and in areas where repatriation is less possible. The second possible solution for a refugee is called host country integration. And that's actually where the majority of refugees are currently. 9 out of 10 refugees are actually in places where the countries are less economically developed. So the burden, if you will, of refugees really rests on those less developed countries. And then the third solution, which is available to less than 1% of the right now 19 million refugees worldwide, gets referred to resettlement to a third country, which could include the United States. We resettle about a half of that 1%. So we resettle by far the most of other countries through the actual resettlement process, but the majority of refugees are actually staying in the host countries which they fled to, Kenya, Ethiopia, Lebanon, Jordan, et cetera. So once somebody is referred through the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees to resettlement, which again is less than 1% of the world's population, they're referred to the country. The refugees don't get to choose which country they're referred to. If they're referred to the United States then activates its system, which they meet with, the refugee will meet with the Department of State and go through a whole series of screening processes, security screening, immigration screening, and medical screening. So they go through a whole series of processes. The process takes on average 18 months to 2 years, and it can take longer, depending on the countries and where they're coming from and how fast those all those processes are working. And knowing many refugees, I've lived and worked alongside refugees my entire life. I met my first refugee when I was 5. And knowing plenty of refugees, I know how hard and difficult and lengthy that process can be. So go ahead and find a refugee to ask those questions, and you'll hear how long and arduous that process is. And once they're referred to the United States and they're admitted into the program after that lengthy screening process, they're matched up with a resettlement agency. The resettlement agency that Catholic Social Services works under is the United States Council of Catholic Bishops, USCCB. There's 9 resettlement agencies in the nation. So in Anchorage, on average, we get about 130, 125 refugees coming through to Alaska. So if the U.S. this year is accepting 85,000 and we're getting 125, that's a very small drop in the bucket. But 125 of those individuals then are referred to our program. And they're referred to our program for one reason. Could be that they have family members here who we have already resettled and who are living here, and so they could be coming through that way. About 25% of our refugees are coming that way. And the other 75 are coming with no connections to the community, but they're coming based on the capacity we have, which is the housing, the medical care that we have here, the employment, all of that, the language, making sure that we have the language of those people here in our community. And that's kind of how they're referred to us. And then we pick them up at the airport, and we see through all their resettlement, reception and placement services. So connecting them to all the basic, all their basic needs and all of the community resources that they'll need to then become self-sufficient and begin their new lives here.
Margaret?
And just to put the numbers in a little bit of more perspective here, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says that we're in the midst of the biggest crisis in world history as far as people being forced from their homes. It's close to 60 million people who have been forced from their homes worldwide. Jessica mentioned the number 19.5 million. Those are the people that the UNHCR officially says are official refugees. Defined refugees under the legal definition. But there's close to 60 million people on the move who either haven't gotten into the UNHCR system yet, haven't been classified as refugees yet, but somehow have been forced from their homes. This is a bigger number of people than at the end of World War II, which was the last major crisis, and the crisis that led to the modern refugee system. So we're in the midst of a massive international crisis involving close to 60 million people moving because of conflicts, being forced from their homes. This is in addition to other migrants, you know, economic migrants, they're not including in that number. So this is 60 million people that have been forced from their homes currently around the world. And we're talking about Anchorage taking less than 150 people per year out of this huge number that's on the move worldwide. Interestingly, there are countries that you wouldn't think of that are taking vastly more numbers of folks that have been forced from their home. A surprise to many people, Russia, believe it or not, has about 1 million people living in Russia right now who've been forced from their home, primarily from Ukraine, and so they're Russian speakers. But you know, most people don't think of Russia as a place where refugees or displaced persons settle, and yet they're taking in many more people than we are at the moment.
So you note the, compared to the scale of the problem of, you know, displaced persons, refugees, the number that actually show up in Anchorage is actually quite small, which I think talks to degrees of misperceptions that exist publicly regarding the nature of the problem, the immediacy of those concerns. So from your perspectives, and we'll start with you, Margaret, what do you think are the most problematic misconceptions that kind of get repeated in the public discussion on this?
Well, the biggest one, of course, and we've talked about that already, is that the refugees are some kind of major security threat to the United States. And in fact, looking at the refugees who've come into the United States, they're not at all. They're vetted so extensively that it's extremely inefficient for any bad person to try to come in. You know, it's a lottery that they're actually going to get placed in the United States. They can't guarantee they're going to end up here. As Jessica mentioned earlier, it's highly unlikely that a given refugee has been accepted by the UNHCR and interrogated and cleared and all that is going to end up in the U.S. because hardly anyone does compared to the worldwide population. And then they get vetted so extensively because we're worried about vulnerabilities in the system that it's just highly unlikely. As we've seen in recent events in the news, unfortunate recent events, it's much more likely that somebody who's going to attack us here in America is going to be a native-born American citizen who got radicalized over the internet or some other way. And we've seen that in Alaska. We've had our terrorism investigations up here have involved native-born American citizens who got radicalized over the internet and decided to launch some attack because they had developed extremist views. We have not had attacks by refugees.
Jessica?
Yeah, so I guess another one of the common misconceptions is that Catholic Social Services picks and choose the clients we serve. We do not determine who is admitted into the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, nor who is in need of resettlement. Those determinations, as I mentioned before, are made. The UNHCR helps make the determination of what is in the best interest of each refugee. Remember, there's two other solutions besides resettlement that are more likely. And then the U.S. government, through the Department of State, are the ones that actually administer the refugee admissions program. Catholic Social Services does not pick and choose our clients. We do not discriminate based on national origin, on religion, or anything like that. We take in the clients who are referred to us, and we provide them the resettlement services that they deserve.
Mm-hmm. I think among other misconceptions or misperceptions out there is what happens after the refugee experience. And I think a lot of the rhetoric that's been going about these days really looks upon these people as burdens upon the host country. And I think the reality is somewhat different. Would you be prepared to speak to that a bit?
Sure. So the reality is that within 10 days of arriving to the United States, refugees are enrolled into English classes and enrolled into employment services. So even though they're here legally and eligible for public benefits, they're here and they are ready to work. A lot of our clients are coming from places where they've been denied the opportunity to work. Thinking of the Bhutanese refugees living in Nepal for 15 years, they haven't been able to work legally. And so they get here and they are ready to work. They're ready to contribute, they're ready to learn, and they're ready to prosper in their new community. So that being said, that even though our clients are eligible for public assistance, you know, they get here and within 6 months, about 95% of our clients, on average it goes between 90 and 95, are employed within 6 months. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm sure a lot of you have lived in or traveled in other countries, and you know how exhausting it is and how challenging it can be to learn the language, to learn the new systems. And so those numbers are truly remarkable. And with that, over 90% of our clients actually retain that employment for more than 3 months. So they're getting here, they're finding jobs, they're keeping those jobs. More and more employers are actually coming to us begging for clients because they work so hard and they are dependable, reliable. And it's truly remarkable. We're very proud of our employment statistics. And about 90% of our clients at any given point are employed. And those who are not could have some health condition that maybe they need to attend to, or perhaps those numbers are the people who just got here. There are some caveats to those numbers because a lot of the clients, most of our clients are working in pretty entry-level seasonal employment. And so even though their intention is to work and get right to work, sometimes they're working 2 to 3 different jobs. And with the seasonal economy here, they can be let go and you know, during the off seasons. So that can be a challenge. But other than that, they're here. They're ready to contribute to their community.
And I'm wondering if you can also, Margaret, bring your past military background to bear on this as well.
Sure. I did want to mention that not only are refugees supposed to get a job and integrate into the community and learn English and become part of our society, but they are told to apply for a green card, which is lawful permanent residence. After they arrive here 1 year later, they're supposed to apply for a green card. And then once they get a green card, they're on the track to American citizenship. A typical refugee can become an American citizen about 5 years after reaching the United States. To become a citizen, they have to show that they can pass the English government civics test, that they know about American history, that they speak English, and that they have good moral character and can pass the array of background checks that are in place to check people who are applying for citizenship. So interestingly, in Anchorage, we've had in the past large numbers of refugees coming here, you know, not so large relative to other parts of the country, but we've had people that came in the past from Poland or the former Soviet Union, or even the Balkans years ago as refugees, and they are now American citizens, they're voters in our community, they'll be voting next year in the election cycle, and these are folks who are fully integrated into our community now and are Americans who came many years ago as refugees. And Paul mentioned talking about the military, the United States military actually likes to recruit refugees. Why is this? Because they come from the places in the world where the United States military is deployed. So they speak the languages, they know the people in those villages, they understand the culture. They're not going to make cultural mistakes that will get Americans from native-born Americans who aren't familiar with the culture killed. I have some wonderful stories about that, but when I was working with Special Operations Command, we had a particular individual that was recruited for Special Forces. And a Special Forces team went into a village in Africa, and they brought this young man with them because they thought, oh, he speaks the language, and we need to have somebody along who speaks this particularly obscure African language. He comes from Africa. He was a refugee. They brought him into the village, and it turned out not only did he speak the language, but he was from this village. And you cannot imagine the impact he had on that mission. He was instrumental to the success of the mission because he knew everybody in the village. He knew who stole whose fish, you know, 25 years ago. He knew all the political players, and he was coming back in an American military uniform, which made a tremendous impression on the people of the village. He was basically treated as a returning heroic figure in a way, and people were really interested, and he ended up getting a medal from Special Operations Command because of his contributions to the mission, which was a success.
I think that word contribution, I think, is a very important part of this discussion that's not been getting enough play. In terms of Anchorage, a highly diverse community, and as you've mentioned, past experience has brought people from many areas. What have been some of the larger groups, refugee groups, over the past few years that have been placed in Anchorage?
Yeah, so in the last 5 years-ish, most of our clients are coming from Somalia, Sudan, Bhutanese refugees, Nepali-speaking Bhutanese refugees, Burmese, Iraqis. And most of the Iraqis who have come in through our program have actually come in on special immigrant visas, which are awarded to people who have cooperated with the U.S. military overseas. And it's the reason that they have had to flee their home. And so most of those Iraqis have gone through that program. We also have more and more Congolese coming to this area. I don't know how much most of you know about the Congo, but it's actually labeled as one of the most inhospitable places on Earth. Very devastating situation in the Congo that has been going on for a long time. And thankfully, the U.S. is resettling more and more Congolese this year. We actually got a Rwandan family that had been living in a refugee camp for 21 years. The average length of time right now is 17 years in a refugee camp. We also are getting more and more Eritrean, Ethiopians. We have some Cubans. And then our program actually also serves foreign-born victims of trafficking, those with special immigrant visas, Cuban, Haitian entrants, and asylees, once they've been granted asylum.
And past flows we've seen, or at least I've seen in my office, I usually deal with the refugees after they've come further along, they've gotten the green cards and they're applying for citizenship. We've had folks from Vietnam, from Laos, other places in the world where we've had conflicts, the Balkans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the former Soviet Union countries, again, we'll be continuing to get some of those. We've had some Ukrainians, Russian, Uzbekistanis, and we'll be getting some more this year with family reunification. So they're reunifying with family who have been here for quite a long time.
I think everyone wants to know about the Syrians, though, and so far I have not seen a single Syrian refugee in Alaska.
So, well, what does tend to bring particular groups, or just how do they come to Anchorage? What brings them to Anchorage? Is it simply random, or is it?
A lot of it is random, yes, and a lot of it is dependent on if they have family here in the community. Mm-hmm. So about 25% of our clients, sometimes more, depending on the regions like the former Soviet Union countries. So about 25% are coming because they have family here, and the other percentage is luck of the draw. And a lot of it has to do with the capacity of the community, the language, et cetera, that exists in the community to support them. The medical services are a big one. Mm-hmm. So if somebody has an urgent or significant medical situation that we can't support here in Anchorage, they will go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Another part of this that I think people don't understand, a misconception, we heard in the news after the Paris attacks that states were trying to bar certain refugees from coming to their states. Once a refugee is admitted into the United States, that person is legally here and can move, just like a U.S. citizen can move from Alaska to another state. So we do see some flows across state borders where somebody who's been settled as a refugee in Louisiana might decide to come to Alaska. maybe to work in the fishing industry. So they'll end up resettling up here, but not officially coming in as a refugee to Alaska. They'll be processed initially in Louisiana, and then they'll find out there's a great job in Alaska. I'm getting on a plane, I'm coming up here. Mm-hmm. And those numbers wouldn't be counted typically through Catholic Social Services. But once a person gets to Alaska and decides it's a great place to live, they might tell their friends and so on. And then you end up seeing flows of people who were settled somewhere else in the United States coming to Alaska. And we also see the reverse. We've had some folks who got up to Alaska and they come from a climate that is particularly maybe different from what they expected up here. And they find that, you know, California is perhaps more to their liking, or Florida, and they move back because there's nothing to really stop them from, you know, leaving our lovely state and moving to some place that they perceive to be a little warmer.
I will just add that we do work a lot with secondary migrants, and those are refugees who are under their five-year period who have moved from another state to Alaska. So we do serve them, but yes, it's very true. A lot of them are living independently, and so they won't necessarily come get services from us, but they are eligible for services for up to 5 years.
And so theoretically, there is a point at which a person who originally has come to the United States as a refugee, you know, that status ceases to have meaning, you know, presumably at the point at which they become a citizen or even before that.
Well, there are some conditions. There are some ways that a refugee could lose their refugee status. And as the immigration attorney, you could probably speak more to that. So
if they behave badly, they commit crimes, they can be subject to deportation mm-hmm. from the United States.
But I think the basic point is just because one comes as a refugee, that doesn't basically, at some point, that's part of the backstory. It's not part of the present and what they're contributing. I think certainly that's a very, very familiar story for many of us in this room and in Anchorage. Anchorage is a place where you decide very quickly whether it suits you or not. And those of us whom it suits have decided to stay, and those of us who it does not suit have decided to move on. If you have the opportunity, or when you have the opportunity to speak to a public forum, what is kind of the one or two most important points that you think people need to understand, the idea that needs to be out there as we continue to have this debate, which obviously being an election year, it's going to continue to be a debate. So what do you think are the one or two most important things that people need to keep in mind on this issue?
I would say one of the most important things to remember is that refugees have gone through some very significant traumatic experiences. In order to actually be defined as a refugee, you have to have gone through something before you even left your country, during the flight stage, which for some people can be a very prolonged stage. For some people, it's a pretty fast thing, but as we're seeing right now, especially in Syria, that the flight is actually a long time. People are traveling overseas, they're walking for days through various countries. So that flight, there's a lot of things that can happen on the flight. There's a lot of things that can happen with a person when they're being displaced and living in a refugee camp. And then resettlement to the United States or another country is a whole nother level. But I think that it's important to remember that refugees have not always been refugees. They are people who are coming with various life experiences, experts in many levels, in various fields. And they're coming here with a drive to rebuild their lives. They're some of the strongest, most resilient, resourceful people that you'll ever meet. And so that's kind of the big takeaway for me.
Margaret?
Well, and I think that's important to emphasize because there is a perception out there in some parts of the public that a refugee must be somebody who doesn't have an education and, you know, hasn't got background that will allow them to integrate in our society, and that's often not true at all. There are people with advanced degrees. There are people who've had computer training, people ready to run a small business, people ready to work hard, as Jessica said. And I think, you know, if you realize what the process is that they've gone through, you have to be a pretty resilient person to get through that process and to manage to get through all these bureaucratic loopholes or obstacles and get to the United States eventually. You're going to have a lot of resiliency built into you, and that's going to serve you well in the workforce.
So I think this might be a good time to open up the floor to further discussion.
Hi. Have you explained all this to our congressional delegation?
I would love the opportunity to explain that. Unfortunately, I think people started issuing press releases immediately without checking with anybody. And I saw that with, unfortunately, with a number of our state legislators as well, that one unfortunate press release immediately after the Paris attack said that we should stop all immigration to Alaska of any kind. And I thought, okay, no oil workers are allowed to come in, no computer technicians are allowed to come in. What about all those people on our military base? You know, at Fort Richardson, Jay Bear, we have a lot of people serving in the military who are immigrants. That one legislator called for a halt to citizenship ceremonies at the federal courthouse, which I thought was interesting because we have a number of military spouses who are supposed to get sworn in next week as citizens, and our legislator wanted to halt those, doesn't want the military spouses to get their citizenship. But I think, you know, it's important to think about what people are saying and check your facts. The Paris attacks, as far as we can tell at this point, were carried out by Europeans, Belgians and French. You know, there's a rumor that one person may have snuck into Europe using the refugee channels with this mass migration, but he wasn't classified by the UN as a refugee. He just snuck through, you know, the land border somehow, possibly. We don't know that for sure. So Belgians and French don't get checked when they come to Alaska. Mm-hmm. And you know that because you've run into a whole bunch of them. They come to visit for the Iditarod. And they come, you know, for tourism and so forth and so on. They come on the ESTA program where they're waived, their visa is waived, and they don't get an interview by anybody when they come through, other than a quick check at the border with the border agent. So I think overreacting is a real danger when you hear stories in the news. And the first reports out of a lot of these incidents are often unfortunate, and groups get blamed, and then it's almost a panic flash mob out there on the internet. Deciding that we're going to protect ourselves better by categorizing a whole bunch of people as a threat and just stopping all those people from coming here. And I do wish our legislators would check some facts before they issue their press releases. I think that would help a lot and stem the tide of panic.
Yes, please.
My name is Fari. I have been a student. I have been a student of Michael Stock. And I'm not a refugee, but I'm an asylee. And I'm a little bit familiar with this, with what they are talking about here. When we do not understand something, we tend to be scared of it. And especially when things like what's going on right now in the world is going on. And we tend to blame everybody that looks like what the problem is. But that's not the truth. And I'm so glad that you guys have verified that here. Thank you. I volunteered with Catholic Social Services, and I know a little bit about the refugee program and the process. And thanks for mentioning that refugees, employers are calling you for refugee workers because they're hardworking people. Enlightening us, it's great. Now, everybody in here who is going to go back and talk to their representative or whatever it is, would let them know exactly what it is that's going on. It's not true that everybody out there, it's a problem. And that's just not the truth. So for that matter, I'm just going to say that thank you so much for doing what you have done and enlightening us, because some of us were confused about this whole notion that it's those people that are coming in here that are going to be affecting us or attacking us. No, that's not true. Not everybody is going to attack or everybody is a bad person. So my question to you would be, how much more are you going to take this out there? Because a lot more people need to hear about this. And it's like it's not quite there yet. Margaret explained that it's not the refugee that's attacking here in the United States. It's United States citizens that were radicalized that are attacking here. So keep doing what you're doing. Take it out there and let more people understand this. It's great. Thank you.
First, I'd like to thank the two ladies for all the information that you have given us, especially for starting out with the definition. I think too often we just throw these terms around generally, and there certainly is a difference. I'm Jay Jackson from Helping Hand for Nepal, and just two points of clarification. Knowledge is both a powerful thing positively and negatively. When you give statistics, please just really be careful to compare two things that are the same. So if I'm going to say that 185 refugees come to Alaska per year, I don't want to hear it compared to an entire country. And the figure given for Russia, we weren't told if it was for a year. Every year is it that many? The last 10 years and the whole total existence of Russia on the face of this universe. So I can't put that into any perspective. And I like statistics. I want that perspective. So in a second, when I finish, if you could clarify, that would be great. The other thing is when you say that people are in refugee camps, and I've been in some, and they are horrible. I won't dispute that. But in a country like Nepal that is recognized as one of the poorest and least developed countries in the world, those people do not have jobs. Many of them live in absolute poverty, which means they live below their means to keep themselves humanly healthy. When people live in poverty in this country, it's relative to the average standard of living in this country. So the reason those refugees in Nepal were not allowed to work wasn't because they didn't want to be able to have them to work. The Nepalis don't have any work. The majority of children in Nepal eat one meal a day of roasted maize. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. You make a really good point. It goes back to what I had mentioned before, that the burden, if you will, of refugees is actually placed on those countries that are less economically developed and less able to support refugees. And there's a whole slew of tensions that exist in countries like Chad, Ethiopia, Kenya, Nepal, because of that, because the people living there already have scarce resources. And so adding that other population can be burdensome to those populations. And just to let you all know, refugee admissions to the United States, that's all public information. You can go online and find that information. To Alaska and to the United States as well, that's all public information.
We also did give you a handout that shows the numbers in the United States, and I want to make sure everybody's aware that it's on the back table if you didn't get it, which probably explains why we weren't so clear in discussing it. But if you take a look at the handout that says an overview of U.S. refugee law and policy, on the second page you'll see the numbers for the United States. There's a chart there showing how many refugees were admitted to the United States. And these are, of course, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, officially accepted refugees, and these show the numbers. And this year it's projected to be 85,000 people. Again, the United States is about 322 million people, and we're going to take about 85,000 this year. The Russians do not take as many UNHCR official refugees as they do other people forced from their homes. And so the million people, it's actually in a year that Russia's taken that, but it's coming from the Ukraine. And if you've been to World Affairs Council events on the Ukraine, you know what the conflict is that's going on there. And there's extremely large numbers of people moving from the Ukraine to Russia who speak Russian and feel more comfortable they're being forced from their homes in the Ukraine because of the conflict, so they're moving into Russia. And Russia is not going through the UNHCR process with those folks. So those are people that are displaced directly near the Russian border and are moving into Russia and seeking jobs and so forth. And they don't sign up with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, typically. Although UNHCR does work with Ukrainian refugees as well.
When you talk about work, you make it sound like they're all adults. Are there families and children who are also refugees?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Worldwide, more than 50% of the world's refugees are children. Right now, there are 3 million stateless children. Those are children that do not belong to any state. And there's a whole slew of consequences for us as a global community, but also for those individuals and their families. You know, without lack of a birth certificate, access to regular medical care, education, that has a lot of impact on the communities that they're living in, and also their future, their employability later on. But about 50%, a little more than 50% of those coming in through the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program are children, and then about a quarter are elderly. And so with our program, we do have a lot of families, and I didn't talk about our families, but you know, watching the families and watching the children come in and really flourish in their new community is definitely one of the joys of our program. And we work really closely with the school district. We have a refugee school liaison person who's here right now. And she does a lot to support our youth that are coming in, as well as the parents that are coming in through our program.
Hi, thank you both for coming. I just, on the broader topic of immigration, Margaret, you mentioned some legislators were calling to halt immigration, and the refugees are a small part of that number. But could you talk about the demographic challenges the U.S. is currently facing? And how your immigrants can help fix that?
Well, the U.S. is facing a demographic problem, which we probably haven't come to grips with yet, which is we're looking at a rapidly aging population, fewer working-age people in the future available to pay into our entitlement system and therefore fund the folks who want to retire. We're looking at having a very large number of people of retirement age compared to the working-age population coming in the next 20 to 30 years. And we have not been as impacted by the demographic change as other countries with similar problems. You might have heard the stories from Japan and Italy. The reason we haven't been impacted so much is because of immigration, which includes some of the refugees coming in, but of course they're a pretty small number. The immigrants are the ones that are keeping our Social Security fund relatively robust for the immediate future because they tend to come in as younger folks. And they tend to be of working age, and they're able to work, and they're paying into the system. And so one of the things we need to think about when we're looking at immigration is how it impacts demographics. And we talked earlier about the military, but the military is having a huge problem right now finding qualified military-age American young people who can join the United States military. When I say that to people, that often comes as a shock, but it's true. Only 2 out of 10 Americans of military age can meet military enlistment standards right now. And the Department of Defense is seriously worried about this. It's everything. It's criminality, can't complete high school, can't pass the Armed Forces qualification test, can't meet Armed Forces physical fitness standards. You know, I can say soda pop, and you'll know what I mean, but we have an obesity problem in America that prevents people from joining the military. We have people that have drug problems. I know a lot of folks favor legalization of marijuana, but that creates a problem for military recruiting. The military will not take somebody who's a habitual pot smoker. Even if it's legal for them to smoke pot, the military doesn't want to give them a weapon and have them on a battlefield if they're habitual drug users. So, you know, all these factors come into play with the demographic issue, but the same problems facing employers. I don't know if you saw the news story recently with the Anchorage Police Department having a great deal of difficulty finding qualified people who want to join the police department. Some of these problems are alleviated. They're not solved, but they're alleviated to some extent by allowing immigrants into the country and allowing them to integrate. I know APD likes to recruit from a diverse population. And recruiting folks like this and bringing them in actually makes our country stronger. I worked for a general at Special Operations Command who had a famous saying, diversity is our strength. That got repeated in the news, and he was absolutely correct about that. Having a diverse workforce when you're a global superpower makes a big difference. Makes you much more competitive, not only on the battlefield, but economically. And one of our strengths in Anchorage has been our diversity. It's caused our economy to be a lot stronger because we do have an international workforce and because we can communicate easily with other countries. This has enhanced our economic power as a state to have diversity in our workforce.
With the small amount of refugees that have come to Alaska, is there a decision made on like neighborhoods that they're permitted to move into, or is it just based on financial? I mean, are there specific, you know, like apartments and things that have volunteered for this, or how does that work?
So refugees coming here legally are able to resettle wherever there is availability of housing. So the reality is that our clients are coming in and they're living at poverty level because they're coming in and they're taking these lower level, entry level positions that they're eager to do, but that don't often pay a lot, or they're having to take multiple jobs. And so they're living where the affordable housing is. And that's why they're living in those locations. It's not because they're not permitted in other places, it's because they can only afford to live in certain places.
You mentioned Anchorage as a hub of, for refugees. Are there other parts that they are resettled in, such as Fairbanks or Juneau?
So our program only resettles refugees directly to Anchorage because that's where our office is and that's where the services are. However, our program started out in the Delta Junction region for the former Soviet Union clients. So we do have some former refugees from years past that are living up there. And so some of the family reunifications that I spoke of earlier, some of those families might be reunifying up there. But we only resettle here to Anchorage, and it's because that's where the services are.
Thank you so much. You both alluded to personal connections and stories that led you to be advocates for refugees. I know we don't have a ton of time, but I'd just love to hear a little bit about your personal reasons for doing what you do, what you'd like to share with us about that.
Well, I've been an immigration attorney since 1993 in Alaska. And I've also been an Army reservist at the same time, and of course have spent a lot of time outside Alaska due to the events of the post 9/11 era. But I've worked a lot with immigrants of all sorts, and many of them over the years have been former refugees or refugees. And so that probably has something to do with my interests. And in my family background, I have a deep, dark family secret, which is my ancestors got deported to the United States by the British. In the 1700s, and they would have called themselves refugees at the time because they were being persecuted by the Brits on account of their membership in a particular ethnic group that spoke French. So I think I've given that away, though. So I think somewhere in my DNA, I got a little bit of, you know, the refugee blood long ago.
Yeah, so I grew up in Minneapolis, and I was surrounded by refugees from, like I said, the time I was five. I first started to get to know Hmong refugees and other immigrant populations as well. But since then, I have, you know, scores of colleagues and friends that were Bosnian refugees, that were refugees from Somalia, from Sudan, from Bhutan, from Burma. And so both on a personal and professional level, in all of my sort of, even as a preschool teacher, I was a preschool teacher when I was a full-time student in university, and I worked alongside Somalian refugees. And then I went and I got my master's degree in international human rights, and I focused on refugee studies and humanitarian assistance, and I worked on some projects with both the IRC, the International Rescue Committee, and Save the Children, in their education and emergencies programs. So those are education programs for refugees or those who have been displaced due to emergencies, so natural disaster or war. And so, yeah, I've just known and really had the pleasure of getting to know a lot of these folks very intimately and personally, and my life is better for it.
Hi, my name is Jenny Rogers, and I work at the Alaska Literacy Program. I've been teaching English there for about 10 years, and I have to say that on a personal and professional level, I've had such a rich career by working with the diverse immigrant and refugee communities here in Anchorage. I would like to say that I've made many connections in the community. I've worked with many individuals and families, and there are some challenges about living in Alaska that I'd like to address and just maybe talk about. The students that I work with, they say Alaska's expensive. It's very expensive to live here in housing. There have been some challenges with finding affordable housing here in Anchorage. Also, jobs, it's really hard to find better paying jobs as an immigrant or refugee, especially if you have limited English. So in addition to that, a lot of community members are moving out of the state, or I hear that they are, because we don't have a very large immigrant and refugee base here, and so they're going to other states because there are larger communities that they want to connect with, and I'm a little bit worried about that because I feel like we may lose that diversity here. So these are just some of the challenges, and I'm interested in what some of your thoughts are.
Yeah, so inward and outward migration is a thing. Refugee populations are mobile. They're mobile people. And a lot of that is cultural. If you look at Somalians, they're a very migratory culture. And as all of you in this room, you would want to be by your family. You would want to be by your friends. And so you're going to go where they are. And so we have people leaving the state, but we also have people coming to the state. We were mentioning climate earlier, and surprisingly enough, we just had a family from Somalia who were resettled into Arizona come to Alaska because Arizona was too hot. So there's a lot of things that play in this. We have Bhutanese families who are coming here to live closer to their brothers. So it really just depends. There's not a whole lot. There's inward and outward migration all of the time. And a lot of the people who are in migrating are actually saying that the places that they had been living were very expensive, and that the housing was very expensive. So I think nationwide, even though Anchorage is facing some housing situations and affordable housing crises, I think there are other, well, I know there are other cities and other states that are facing similar challenges. And you know that the job thing is true, it's there. It's very difficult for people who are coming here with qualifications. And a lot of our clients are coming in with degrees. They're coming in with various master's degrees and very technical skill sets that are not easily transferable. And we are working with other community partners to develop some programming to help some of these immigrants and refugees who are coming in with these skill sets that the Anchorage community could really use, and helping see how we can support that. So those are things that are happening, and they do happen a little bit more in other communities, and that just tends to be that a lot of the refugee populations in other communities are a little bit older, and they're a little bit bigger. But with time, you kind of see these programmings develop, because they develop based on the needs of the population. And what we're continuing to hear is that this is a need for our community.
And I could certainly add that that's not the problem of highly qualified people coming and being able to use those skills is not an issue that's confined to immigrants and refugees. Also, just American citizens coming to Alaska also have difficult problems there. So that's certainly something that it might be useful for our legislature to think about in certain ways.
No, I think Jessica covered it pretty well.
Mm. Hi, I'm a student with UAA, and about the Syrian refugees coming into Europe, I've heard reports about 4 out of 5 Syrian passports are fake. I just wanted to know your opinion on that and what you thought about it.
Okay, well, I'm not sure about the number 4 out of 5 are fake because, you know, and I deal with immigration documents all day long, and it's just a fact that people travel around the world with fake documents. Americans have walked into my office with fake documents that they generated to go into some country, you know, because they thought it was cute to fake some document. The security systems are set up now to try to validate everybody's documents when they come in. And, you know, employers in Alaska, I'm sure there's a number of them in the room, know they're supposed to check people's documents when people start work. And there have been, over the years, fake documents kicking around of all sorts in the world. But the fact that somebody might be using a fake document doesn't necessarily mean that they're evil. People often use fake documents to get on an airplane so they can claim asylum in a country. And that's a very common pattern that you see in order to get through a country that's unfriendly or somehow get to a safe haven. People will use false documents. It happened in World War II with Jewish refugees. We're using false documents all over the place to try to get into a country where they could claim safe haven. This happens frequently at international airports, that somebody attempts to get on an airplane and the airlines run everybody's passport, machine-readable passport, to try to figure out whether it's fake or not. If it's fake, they stop you and they don't let you on the airplane. That sort of thing. And you do have to have a valid passport to get on an airplane to come to the United States for the most part. You know, there's exceptions for people with alternative documents. But the fact that people are saying people have fake passports doesn't necessarily mean anything unless you tell me the context, what they're trying to do with it. There are people who were apparently claiming they want to claim asylum in Germany. And in order to get there, they want to pretend to be Syrian because a certain number of people are, they're going to take Syrians but not other people from other countries. And so there's some of that going on. It might interest you to know that the U.S. has had a problem with fake Cuban documents because Cubans are allowed to adjust their status if they're unlawfully here in the U.S. There's something, an old law called the Cuban Adjustment Act, that basically says if you're an unlawfully present Cuban, you manage to get into the United States, you can get a green card. And that's been our law for decades. We don't make Cubans go back to Cuba and get visas. We just give them green cards, essentially. So some people from other countries in South America will try to pretend to be Cuban, and they usually get caught. I would say 99% of the time they get caught, but you know, there's a market of fake Cuban documents to pretend to be Cuban. There have been other groups in the past that have gotten fake documents in order to get on planes, and they get to JFK Airport and they confess to the inspector, hey, this is a fake document, but I want to claim asylum and I needed to use this to get on an airplane. Most of that, though, has been pretty much eliminated as far as the air traffic goes because of the modern security systems and machine-readable passports, and that's why you all now have to get a passport if you're an American citizen and you want to go to Canada. Mm-hmm. They no longer let you just show up at the border with your birth certificate and say, I'm an American, I'd like to go visit Canada. They say, nope, got to have a passport. And that's so that your credentials can be checked. The U.S. State Department has to issue a passport. If you're an American citizen, you're required by law to have a passport to come in and out of the United States. So this is to prevent the fake document problem or minimize it.
I have a question about children that don't have parents to claim refugee status. So if there's orphans or there's maybe a 12-year-old that fled Syria and managed to get into Serbia, let's say, do we accept orphans as refugees? And what happens to them if they come in? Are they put into foster care? Like, how are we addressing that issue?
So that would be called the Unaccompanied Minor Program, and we don't have one here in Anchorage. But yes, the U.S. does accept refugees who've been defined as refugees to come into the the U.S. admissions, refugee admissions program, but we don't have a program here in Alaska. And it works differently depending on where you are and depending on where the person is from. Oftentimes they might be coming to the U.S. or coming to a certain state because they have family there, especially if you're thinking of other populations. With Syrians, there are a lot of Syrian minors who are displaced, not necessarily refugees, even though there's a lot of those as well. And they'd be coming through the Unaccompanied Refugee Minors Program. And then they would be working with the various resettlement agencies to be placed. And yes, foster care usually. But it just kind of depends. Those programs all run a little different.
Oh, last question.
Do you have any agencies that employers can go to? Is it CSS? Or are there any other agencies where employers can have access to?
Catholic Social Services. Yep, we have an education and employment center. And interested employers can contact us directly. Yep, and we help place clients with employers.
All right, well.
That was a short one.
My husband took my turn. So I think what comes up for people is they look at the 9/11 attacks, mm-hmm. and they assume these are people that got into our country potentially through refugee programs or this. So I think maybe what we need to rehear is that how those people came into this country and why they were here as opposed to being refugees.
Good question, and it's one that deserves being emphasized again. The 9/11 attackers all came to the U.S. lawfully on visas issued to them by the State Department at some point. None of them came as refugees. The big hole we discovered in our security system after 9/11 was a student visa. And what these folks had done was applied for student visas and come to the U.S. primarily as student visa holders. Most of them were actually legally in the U.S. on September 11, 2001. Perfectly legal here. One of them got his visa renewal approved after his death by the Immigration and Naturalization Service because he had an application to change status pending with the government, and nobody recognized the name at the service center when they approved the change of status. He had died in the attacks, and they approved him for a change of status. This, by the way, is the reason why there's no longer an Immigration and Naturalization Service. Congress was quite angry with them and got rid of them. And we now have the Department of Homeland Security, and we have three sub-agencies under that deal with immigration, and we have a much more robust security system. Because of 9/11, they put in place the Student Exchange Visitor Information System, where we now track all of the foreign students who come to the United States. They go through much more extensive security checks. If they drop a class, there's usually a DHS agent on their doorstep checking on them to see what's going on. We would like to deport you now. You're no longer in status. And this has been a robust system that was built after 9/11, but none of the 9/11 attackers were refugees. And this gets back to the point I mentioned, tried to mention earlier, is that the enemies are resourceful, and they try to figure out, you know, how can we attack the United States of America? The other day I was on Hometown Alaska, and I mentioned that the bad guys out there don't have aircraft carriers, and they don't have infantry divisions, and they don't have missiles to fire at us, and they can't attack us frontally. So they use the weapons of the weak. And the weapons of the weak are make them afraid and get them to stop letting people into their country, and that will cause their economy to go bad, and then they won't be able to support themselves, and they'll turn their country into a super surveillance state, and that will feed into our message that America's an evil superpower that, you know, wants to do harm to our people. So our enemies want to attack us, make no bones about that, but they're going to pick any possible method for doing that, and they're least likely to pick the methods that are harder and that aren't going to work. And a refugee system is probably the hardest possible system for a bad guy to exploit today. The student visa system is also incredibly difficult to exploit. But the easy system, the one that we've seen in use in recent weeks, is just going on the internet and cultivating somebody and radicalizing them on some jihadi website over the internet and just feeding them information, because there are people in the United States, our fellow citizens, who are willing to attack us in the name of an extremist ideology. And that weapon has proven the most effective, but all the attention you want to pay to the immigration system is not going to stop that. I really wish that we would focus our efforts on the things that are going to make a difference. And the things that will make a difference are developing intelligence on what's going on, how our enemies are trying to radicalize people, how they're successful at doing that, trying to stop that sort of thing. We get a lot of intelligence, by the way, from our immigrant communities. Some of the biggest terrorist attacks in America that you've never heard about didn't happen because an immigrant stopped them. And the number one that I can think of, it didn't happen in Alaska, was in New York City. There were two bad guys who were trying to do suicide vests on the New York City subway years ago, and they had actually built the vests, and they were heading out the door to go into the New York City subway system, and they were going to detonate, do something we call a double tap, where one blew himself up and the other one blew himself up on another car in the subway system. They had this all coordinated. They would have killed thousands of New Yorkers. They were stopped by a male Muslim Egyptian immigrant who happened to have won the diversity visa lottery and had immigrated to America with a green card a couple weeks before, running into these guys in his apartment building. And he was absolutely terrified. They were open with him about what they were doing because they perceived him as being a sympathetic Muslim male immigrant. And sure, he would want to know what they were going to do because, you know, he must be sympathetic. He was not at all sympathetic. He said to himself, this is the end of my life here if these guys succeed. And I love being in America, and I don't want to be in Egypt. And, you know, this is my home now, and I spent a lot of time and energy trying to get here. And he immediately went out and told the New York City Police Department what was going on. They scrambled an emergency services unit, and they stopped these guys when they were on their way out the door getting ready to kill their New Yorkers. Now, you've never heard about this because it didn't happen. And there are thousands of other incidents like that where refugees, asylees, immigrants, U.S. citizens found out about a plot and stopped it. We need to encourage more people to behave that way and to help protect us. That's our most effective weapon, is getting the community involvement, getting people to spot folks that mean to do us harm and put a stop to them before they're able to do that. Thank you.
I think kind of on a concluding note, one of the things is this issue in terms of the public discourse is very often language of fear is employed, but in many respects, the story of refugees and what they've contributed to this country is in many respects a very affirming story about America. And I wish that would be something that came out a bit more in terms of this public discussion. I certainly thank both of you for helping to enlighten us in response to that. So round of applause for our guests.